Hello, and welcome to our program, Comorbid Patients with Multiple Myeloma, Considering All the Facts and Treatment Selection. I am Dr. Sergio Giralt, Chief of the Adult BMT Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College. I am pleased to be joined today by Dr. Beth Feynman from the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. Together, we will share evidence and insights into this somewhat challenging and important topic. Hi, Beth.
Hello, Dr. Giralt. Thank you for having me today.
We hope by the end of our presentation, you'll be able to identify how comorbidities in patients with multiple myeloma can affect treatment choices and, most importantly, the outcomes for your patients. We will review the current guidelines for standard induction regimens for newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients and factors you should be aware of when prescribing certain agents or combinations of agents in patients with comorbidities. In addition, we will spend a few minutes discussing when transplant may or may not be an option for your patients and what drives your treatment decisions. Now, let's begin. These are our disclosures. To get started, Beth, why don't you begin by sharing a case presentation of a patient who is most likely to be seen in the clinical setting, who exemplifies what we want to discuss today.
Thank you, Dr. Giralt. The case presentation that we selected today, I think, mirrors what you'd see in your real-world practice. So here we have a retired 72-year-old factory worker who lives alone. He has a positive past medical history for COPD. He was a 42-pack year smoker, Vietnam War veteran, and hypertension, although it is controlled. This gentleman went to the ER with severe back pain and fatigue. A lumbar x-ray was performed and showed an L1 compression fracture. Subsequently, due to lower extremity weakness, the ER obtained an MRI which showed a soft tissue mass at L1. He was subsequently admitted for pain control and a diagnostic evaluation. His monoclonal protein analysis showed an elevated IgG in lambda and a serum M spike of 4.2 grams per deciliter of blood. He was secreting a fair amount of protein in his urine, about 1.16 grams per 24 hours, but it was mostly albumin. His beta 2 microglobulin was elevated, as well as his LDH and his serum creatinine. A bone marrow biopsy was subsequently performed and only showed 20% clonal lambda-restricted plasma cells and normal cytogenetics and no IgH translocations. And the bone survey was pretty clear except for an L1 mass and a compression fracture. So this bears a question, you know, and I'll put this to you, Dr. Giralt. We have to determine, what is the diagnosis? Does this gentleman need systemic therapy? Is he a candidate for transplant if he does? And what might our other concerns be regarding his comorbid conditions?
So Beth, this is an excellent case. And as you said, it really reflects what we will have in practice. So this patient, with what we see, obviously has a diagnosis of multiple myeloma. He has more than 10% clonal plasma cells. He has a paraprotein peak. And moreover, he has what we would call symptomatic myeloma because he has evidence of an organ damage. We'll talk a little bit more about what is the requirements for therapy further on. What other things could this patient have, and will we know if this patient has high-risk disease? High-risk disease is defined by the stage. An ISS stage 3 with a beta 2 microglobulin of over 5 would be considered high-risk disease, or based on chromosomal abnormalities. A patient with a 414 translocation, deletion 17, gain of chromosome 1, or 1416 translocations are all considered high risk. Now, they're not high risk because they won't respond. These patients respond to initial induction therapy. They're considered high risk because the duration of response is generally less than 2 years. Whether he's a candidate for transplant or not, it's too early to say. A full staging evaluation after induction treatment, his tolerance to induction therapy, and his psychosocial and, you know, caregiver situation will also help us decide whether transplant is the right choice for him or not. Does he need systemic therapy? The answer is definitely yes. Beth, I ask you, I mean, he had a creatinine of 2.4, and I think it's important to recognize that this might be in a more important emergent situation, we really want to protect two things in a patient who's presenting like this. One, we want to avoid nerve root compression, so it's worrisome that he had lower extremity weakness. If that mass at L1 was, you know, contributing to that weakness, he might require rapidly high-dose steroids or radiation. Likewise, if his creatinine from 2 months ago was normal, then again, obviously his myeloma is affecting his kidney, and rapid institution of treatment is necessary to avoid further kidney damage. Beth, what other concerns do you have regarding his comorbidities?
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, this guy lives alone, so I worry about his safety. But going back to his comorbidities, he did have quite a bit of proteinuria. Now, that might be from the temporary renal failure. That might be from his years of hypertension, possibly underlying diabetic nephropathy. But I always worry in the lambda light chain population about kidney amyloid. So he had mostly albumin secreting in his urine, so I might consider working him up for AL amyloidosis as well. Fat pad biopsy, or if he gets a bone marrow biopsy, stain the Congo red bone marrow biopsy. And if I have a high suspicion based on his prior cardiac echoes, you know, look for cardiac amyloid as well by checking the thickness of a myocardium. Now, these are separate from the myeloma diagnosis, but when you're thinking about doing high-dose chemotherapy in an older individual or any systemic therapy, it's so important to look at all those differential diagnoses.
I agree with you, Beth. Now, a lot of people are asking, what is the optimal imaging strategy for a patient with myeloma? We have traditionally used skeletal survey, and that's still in the NCCN guidelines, although we know that the International Myeloma Working Group is starting to change what they consider is the optimal imaging strategy for myeloma.
Right.
At Memorial Sloan Kettering, we will either do a whole body MRI or a PET CT. What would happen in Cleveland Clinic, and what do you think is the optimal imaging strategy for a patient with myeloma today?
Yeah, Dr. Giraud, those are excellent questions. So you were, I believe, an author on the paper from 2018 from the Journal of Clinical Oncology that did updates in bone this year. And so the optimal imaging is pretty much across the board, PET CT or MRI. There's this whole pattern of bone myeloma bone disease that's being described in other papers by Terpos and the International Myeloma Working Group. In my practice, we tend to start with a skeletal survey. And as you mentioned, it fails to identify lesions. Only about 30% to 40% you need bone loss before you can find those lesions. So looking at the myeloma bone pattern of involvement with MRIs of the pelvis or lumbar spine or a whole body PET CT, if you really want to quantify that burden of disease, is really important. So we'll absolutely do it baseline, especially if there's suspicious lesions or plasmacytoma suspected, but subsequent imaging might be more of a challenge depending on one's insurance.
So let's talk a little bit about what we know about multiple myeloma. First, multiple myeloma is a cancer of the plasma cells. The plasma cells are the cells that produce the immune globulins that defend us against infections in response to a foreign body, a bacteria, or a virus. The average age of onset of myeloma is around 70 years. Myeloma cells produce an abnormal immune globulin. 2/3 of them are IgG, 20% of them are IgA, and 5 to 10% of them do not produce a heavy chain, they produce light chain only. And this is what we call as light chain only disease, and it can be either lambda light chain or kappa light chain, depending upon the light chain that the myeloma cell produces. Myeloma cells are recognized in the bone marrow because they are typical plasma cells with eccentric nuclei, a basophilic cytoplasm, but they tend to form clusters. Normal plasma cells usually are isolated. The normal percentage of bone marrow plasma cells is usually less than 5%. When we have more than 10% plasma cells, and these all are clonal, meaning that they're light chain or heavy chain restricted, we say that a patient has multiple myeloma. There are about 50,000 patients with multiple myeloma living in the United States today, and this number is increasing every time because the survival of patients has improved with the improvement of treatment. It happens primarily in older patients. It's more common in African American and males more than females, and it seems to be associated with obesity and environmental exposures. Interesting, our patient was a Vietnam veteran. And we know that there is an increased incidence of myeloma in Vietnam veterans that were exposed to Agent Orange. We also now know that first responders to the 9/11 attacks, as well as individuals who were in the downtown of New York who were exposed to the different dust that happened after the towers collapsed, also have a higher risk of myeloma. Traditionally, myeloma had presented with back pain, bone pain, fatigue because of anemia and pathologic fractures. It's interesting that in the United States at least, the number of patients who are being diagnosed without any symptoms is starting to increase because we're diagnosing it early. So I think one of the most important things to recognize is A, that more and more patients are being diagnosed with multiple myeloma because we are looking for it more frequently, and these patients are living longer because treatment has improved significantly over the last decade. Beth, in light of our patient's presentation and our discussion, let's review the definition of active myeloma in the 2014 International Myeloma Working Group updated criteria.
Yes, of course. And this was new and hot off the presses a couple years ago, but now it's 2018, 2019, and this is kind of old news. But historically, we have this CRAB acronym. So in olden days, I say, which is, you know, 2000s, early 2000s, we identified this CRAB criteria by the International Myeloma Working Group papers, and we waited until end organ damage. And how funny is that to me these days? Because why wait until somebody has hypercalcemia or kidney problems, renal complications, anemia, or bone disease? Why wait until one has damage to their bones? And so the working group got together and identified through meta-analysis the key features in which patients were likely to require treatment. And that include clonal bone marrow plasma cell percentage of greater than 60%, an elevated kappa to lambda serum free light chain ratio of greater than 100, and an MRI with more than one focal lesion. And again, that goes to the myeloma pattern of bone involvement, and that lesion has to be greater than 5 millimeters. So basically, we're trying to identify patients earlier and intervene earlier prior to them having myeloma-defining events or MDE.
It's interesting, Beth, that I think we have to put things in historical perspective, because particularly a lot of the fellows in training and the junior faculty always wonder, so why were you waiting for patients to have renal complications, anemia, or bone disease? And one, it has to do with the fact that at that time we didn't have a lot of treatments and the treatments were not very good. Now, with all the treatments that we have that are extremely effective, I agree with you, we should not wait for patients to fracture, and that these new myeloma-defining events actually go a long way to preventing patients to progress to symptomatic disease. More importantly, the whole field of high-risk smoldering myeloma is also starting to come aboard. And there are actually now a lot of clinical trials looking if there are patients with high-risk smoldering myeloma that do not have myeloma-defining events. Should these patients be considered for treatment too, to prevent them from developing multiple myeloma in the future?
Yeah, so along those lines, I think we went over the history and physical exam of our patient. Again, he was a Vietnam vet. He had the typical hypertension, hyperlipidemia, COPD, common things that you would see in clinical practice. But at diagnosis and throughout, so this is fluid, so people change and treatment changes them, but look at his history of bleeding. Does he have any GI bleeds or a history of DVTs? That might put him at risk for bleeding if he's placed on aspirin or thromboembolic events. Comorbidities, we talked about the cardiac and renal status concerns, and diabetes. I think we underestimate many of these patients. We'll get into treatment in a few moments, but many of these patients will require corticosteroids. And for those who have an underlying diabetes, this could be a real big deal with severe high diabetic ketoacidosis or that non-ketotic state. I've seen that quite a few times. Looking at other malignancies, signs of amyloid, we mentioned that is the differential diagnosis of our case study. We also have to make sure we do an effective diagnostic workup. And that workup is at baseline and throughout. You want to make sure that you obtain the correct baseline studies, and then that needs to be repeated on a monthly basis for most of our patients. And there are numerous papers to guide us as to what to order. But for example, ruling out other signs of anemia, maybe not in our case study, but in the typical patient with this monoclonal gammopathy or MGUS, you know, is the iron or vitamin B12 deficiency playing into whether or not they have anemia? Are they bleeding? We discussed using stains for amyloid in their bone marrow, or a simple fat pad biopsy is really important, especially if they have nephrotic range proteinuria. Now, our patient's proteinuria was less than 4 grams per deciliter, so it's not in that range, but it's high enough to warrant suspicion. The beta-2 microglobulin and LDH are very important for prognosis. An LDH outside of the normal range can be considered high risk in addition to the cytogenetics, and of course the quantitative immunoglobulins, and don't forget IgD. The 24-hour urine assessment, and that's the monoclonal protein as well as the total protein, is also very important as well.
We're currently not using the heavy light chain assay, Beth. Are you using
Neither
that in
we.
Cleveland Clinic?
No, not yet. I feel like we have enough tools in our toolbox to appropriately diagnose and monitor our patients, and we don't reliably have that test to date in our institution that we use.
And actually, we need to tell our audience also not to forget that it's always important to look back at medical records to see what the tempo of the disease is. It is different to approach a patient who's had actually chronic renal failure because of diabetes or hypertension, as opposed to somebody who actually had a normal renal function 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. In one, you can say that this patient, the myeloma is probably not contributing to the renal failure. In the other one, you have to say the myeloma is contributing to the renal failure, and rapid institution of treatment is absolutely necessary.
Absolutely.
Oh, Beth, as you think about this patient and with all your experience, what comorbidities of this particular patient and what in his social situation make you worry about what treatment may or may not do to him? You actually mentioned diabetes, which I think is important because at the moment we start high-dose dexamethasone, these patients need to be followed carefully to prevent them from hitting the emergency room with a blood sugar of 300. What other things can a practicing physician or their team take into consideration to make the beginning of treatment easier?
The most important things we forget about are the mood swings that are associated with those corticosteroids. So the doses of dexamethasone are high, and so you think about the metabolic concern with the hyperglycemia that might be poorly controlled. But I also worry about mood swings. So if this is a Vietnam vet, he might have a history of post-traumatic stress disorder or depression, and so he needs a thorough psychologic evaluation, in my opinion, and we try to do at least a brief one with most. Just the usual, the kidney disease and diabetes, I think in his case would be the most important. But again, in the back of my mind, for all these newly diagnosed older individuals, I'd look at his lung function, knowing he has a COPD diagnosis, and try to make sure to get at least a baseline echo and EKG, or one within the last couple of years, to kind of rule out that idea of cardiac amyloidosis.
And you think, Beth, this is in this situation, it's also extremely important. The patient is 70 years old. As you pointed out, he may be at risk for steroid-induced diabetes or steroid-induced mood swings. And that now with other drugs that are so potent, we really don't need to give the 40 milligrams of dexamethasone to this patient. And actually, the NCCN guidelines would actually recommend giving 20 milligrams of dexamethasone as part of the induction treatment. Beth, do you think it's important to reach out to the primary care doctor, the pulmonologist or the cardiologist, if he has one, and kind of make a group decision of, you know, what the situation is?
Absolutely. So this gentleman was admitted in the hospital, so I'm hopeful that in his case he had the benefits of a multidisciplinary team. The nephrologist was likely consulted as well as his primary care provider, at least in some of the larger institutions. You might just be faced with having the internist at hospitalization at the time of diagnosis pushing all these buttons, but Absolutely, involving the whole treatment team, and that takes us back to the team of the nurses, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, pharmacists, and bringing in everybody's expertise to help arrive at the best care as possible for the patient is very important.
And I just think as practicing guidelines in a patient like this, you would say cardiopulmonary disease, COPD, carfilzomib may not be the first drug of choice for somebody like that because of the problems of hypertension, cardiopulmonary toxicity. His, you know, creatinine was elevated, so starting with an IMID like lenalidomide might produce severe myelosuppression, so that might not be our first course of induction. Whether he has neuropathy or not might decide how we're going to dose the bortezomib, whether we will give it twice a week or once a week. Any other hints or comments that we should be giving our audience about how we would approach a patient like this?
No, I think by keeping in mind, Dr. Giralt, those key things, do not forget, by getting a good baseline, just the what's his overall DVT risk? You know, he had 42 pack years of smoking, but is he still smoking? Or did he start smoking once he learned that he has multiple myeloma? So keeping in mind those comorbid conditions are super important. And by the way, this gentleman does not have peripheral neuropathy. That's the one thing he does not have. So that we'll keep in the back of our mind.
So Beth, how would we approach this patient with multiple myeloma?
Yeah, so as Dr. Giralt likes to describe how he thinks about treatment and describe treatment, he thinks of it as in buckets. And so describing the induction phase where you want to get that individual into a best remission that you can, generally giving them anywhere from 2 to 4 or more cycles of chemotherapy or novel therapy, whatever. Again, thinking of clinical trials, because we haven't gotten to where we are with myeloma without using the clinical trials. So that's important, but inducing a response is important. And then we'll talk about the role of transplantation in multiple myeloma, and that would be the second phase, the transplant plus or minus a consolidation phase, and then the maintenance. So you can get through the induction chemotherapy and then lower that same type of treatment that induced that remission into the maintenance, and we'll discuss that. And then the treatment of relapsed disease. And throughout this is supportive care. One of the things that we've identified in our clinical practice is that we probably don't start bone strengthening agents or bone modifying agents early enough. In review of our charts, and this is not yet published data, for one reason or another, even though the guidelines for the International Myeloma Working Group support the starting of bone modifying agents, that's your bisphosphonates, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but we don't start those early enough. For one reason or another, we hold those and then they might not get started for a couple months. But knowing that our patients require these is important. Other supportive care would be minimizing the risk of thromboembolic events, infectious complications. There was a paper that was published at ASH last year that looked at starting levofloxacin within the first few months of induction therapy to minimize the risk of early death in Europe. And so keeping these things in mind are really important. So again, the standard approach to myeloma is a continuum as well.
So should we treat or not to treat, and how would you discuss this with this patient?
So we balance the clinical experience, that of which Dr. Giralt and my experience and with my colleagues, and then we would take data from clinical research, the study results, and then obviously the patient preference. So if this individual doesn't drive a car or have resources for transportation, he might not want to come to the clinic twice a week for an infusion. Maybe an oral therapy, if he's adherent, would be best. So again, discussing the risks and the benefits and working with the patient is important. Balancing the financial and physical implication, and of course the comorbid conditions as well. And we'll talk more about transplant or not coming up.
So you think it's also essential to have a multidisciplinary approach, particularly in the places where you have access to geriatricians or access to social workers and psychiatrists.
Absolutely.
These patients are we really have to approach them as a team to make the journey. We might not be able to make it easy, but we could try to make it less difficult. So Beth, when you think about this, and we're blessed that we are in large centers, but for the community physician, who should they access? I mean, besides their families, caregivers, social workers, and other members of the support system, correct?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So accessing the social workers and the family members is important. But I really encourage most of the support groups I attend and my patients to get an opinion from a qualified myeloma physician that does this every day. We're not trying to steal your patients. We really are not. But that will provide an extra layer of support for that patient. And we will, and we do this all the time in our practice. We'll go back and forth. They'll see us annually, and then they'll be able to receive their care locally. So I think it benefits the patient, it benefits us, and it definitely benefits the knowledge gained in the community physician that might only see one or two myeloma patients.
I think that's an excellent recommendation. There are myeloma centers of excellence throughout the country. We're always willing to see patients, send them back to their community, but Absolutely. Give them what we think is the best approach for that individual patient. And there are, you know, resources in many of the myeloma centers of excellence that in the community may not be available and may mm-hmm. help the practicing physician and his team to take better care mm-hmm. of the patient and avoid complications from happening in the future.
I think of funding support as the big thing that our patients will have access to, and it's worth the trip for most of my patients, I think. So
we've talked a lot about, should this patient be considered for transplant? Should they not be considered for transplant? I think we've already made the decision this patient needs treatment. And the goal of treatment is usually always the same. We want to give all our patients the longest life with the best quality of life with the least amount of treatment necessary. Now, in myeloma, we know that depth of response is important. And when we look at a patient like this 72-year-old who otherwise is fit, he's independent, he, you know, does all his activity of daily living, we should really try to look for the deepest response possible. Initially, a complete remission, and then we'll talk towards the end about measurable residual disease or minimal residual disease, as it was previously known, as a surrogate endpoint for treatment. Now, the question of whether this patient should proceed to transplant or not, in the early phase, I usually mention it to the patient, but I don't go too much into details because a lot of it will be informed by the response to treatment and the tolerance to initial induction therapy. Do you think that's a correct way of approaching it, Beth?
Absolutely. I see a lot of our patients have what I call the deer in the headlight approach. Mm-hmm. It's the diagnosis you often weren't expecting to hear, and delivering little pieces of information within the first few months is important, and getting in your nurses and social workers, as well as getting an extra set of ears from caregivers if they have one available.
So the question is always asked to me, why are you talking about transplant in a patient who's 70 years old? And really, if a patient's 70 years old, their life expectancy is more than 10 years. And as we will hear in younger patients, high-dose melphalan and autologous transplantation has a significant impact in progression-free survival, and there are some trials that actually have a survival benefit. So I would tell patients, look, even in patients 70, 75 years of age, there may be a significant benefit for aggressive therapy with the intent of achieving the deepest remission possible. We actually look at patients now who are over the age of 70. We now have ASCO practice guidelines that are looking at how should we address chemotherapy and oncologic therapy for older patients. These guidelines ask us, should geriatric assessment be used in older patients to predict adverse outcomes? The answer is definitely yes. There are multiple geriatric assessment tools that can let us predict what adverse events may occur, and whether we should dose adjust chemotherapy. In reality, what we tell older patients, if you're fit, we should go for the full treatment. If you're frail, we should avoid treatment that will provide excessive toxicity. The also thing that's important is, what's the life expectancy of a specific patient? So obviously, the way we approach an 85-year-old is totally different than the way we approach a 75-year-old. The way we approach an 85-year-old who has congestive heart failure is also different as opposed to a 75-year-old. The way we approach a 70-year-old who has severe comorbidities, coronary vascular disease, two strokes, also is different. So I think the American Society of Clinical Oncology is trying to tell all of us practicing physicians that age is just a number. That when we look at older patients, we have to look at their comorbidities, their life expectancies, and there are now multiple tools that will help us decide whether we should treat a patient aggressively with the intent of a long-term disease control or whether we should treat patients with more palliative intent. So at minimum, what we've been telling, I think all patients who are over the age of 60 should be assessed for function, comorbidities, have they fallen lately, are they depressed, what are their cognitive function, and what's their nutritional status. If you do not have a geriatrician close by or if it's inconvenient, all of these tools are available at the ASCO guidelines. They're relatively easy to administer, and they can be administered by a nurse practitioner, physician assistant, or the physician in a relatively short period of time and should be considered part of the standard evaluation of any myeloma patient over the age of 65 in which you're getting ready to administer chemotherapy. Beth, what do you think are the other real life considerations?
Right. Well, one of the things we use is the eyeball test. So if they look good, then they're fit for chemotherapy. But I just wanted to comment on those guidelines. As onerous as it seems to administer those tests, I think it's really important. But also important is one's overall health status. I think we've successfully reiterated during this discussion the acute and chronic disease of the kidney. You know, as Dr. Giralt mentioned, this gentleman might have had a creatinine of 1.3 last year. Now it's elevated, but what if it was always 2.3 or 2.4? So taking into consideration historical values is very important. He must have sought medical care from time to time if his hypertension is controlled. As we mentioned, the COPD and smoking history, whether or not the hypertension is still controlled, and then the diabetes risk because of the corticosteroid use. We also reiterated the importance of his living situation. Maybe he lives alone, but he has a very supportive neighbor or a significant other. Can he drive back and forth to treatments or access public transportation? And what's important to assess is many insurances will have transportation assistance that can be set up as part of their medical benefit. Clinical trial participation is also very important to consider, especially if in a center of excellence. The functional assessment, again, if they're up and moving around, I think it's real important to assess that as well. Or if they're laying in a or if they're laying in a lounge chair.
So what you're saying, it's not how old you are, but how you carry your age, correct?
Yes, of course, of course. And that's a real important point.
So Beth, let's review the options for treatment at this point. So we know that in somebody like him, who is potentially transplant eligible, he is, although with comorbidities, he's independent, his activity is of daily living, he has no really gross losses of his functional status. So we should really try to go for long-term disease control. There are three drug regimens and two drug regimens. All the randomized trials have shown that for fit patients, three drug regimens are superior than two drug regimens. And the one most commonly used in the United States is the combination of bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone. However, in this patient with a creatinine of 2.4, we would probably start him with a combination of cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. And if his kidney function improves after one or two cycles, we would then begin bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone. Bortezomib, we would give in the standard dose of 1, 4, 8, and 11, but we would give it subcutaneously to reduce the risk of neuropathy. Would we think about carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone? In this patient, I do not think it's a good choice, partly because of the fact that he has the renal dysfunction and the cardiopulmonary dysfunction. For patients who are much frailer or patients with severe comorbidities, and particularly, again, for that 80-year-old that we're talking about, or the patient whose life expectancy is relatively limited because of the other comorbidities, then it makes sense to do continuous therapy with a doublet, such as lenalidomide dexamethasone or bortezomib dexamethasone. The combination of melphalan-prednisone and thalidomide is something that's used in Europe, but not used in the United States. You mentioned the fact of patient preference, and that is there are all oral regimens like lenalidomide, ixazomib, dexamethasone. You were saying, Beth?
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just had a thought. You know, we, based on data from a large trial, the acyclone trial, daratumumab in combination with bortezomib, melphalan, and dexamethasone is now approved. Have you been using that in your practice, Dr. Giralt, or when would you consider? Because that was a population that was transplant ineligible.
So I think that is, thank you for bringing that up. That is now approved in the United States. Melphalan, prednisone, thalidomide are not really very commonly used. So the dara-melphalan combinations are not commonly used. But remember, you don't have to use dara in combination with the MPT regimen. So what I have seen from many practicing physicians for older patients is the use of daratumumab together with either dexamethasone or the addition of lenalidomide or the addition of bortezomib in the standard doses or in ameliorated doses. We do not know what the long-term data is of this regimen. It has not been published, but it is being commonly used in the United States.
Yeah, I think that it makes sense to consider a standard approach to him and see if he wants to opt for transplant after a psychological evaluation, assessment of caregiver support. Again, a transplant should not be taken lightly. We want to make sure that he has support and resources if he goes on that route. But his renal function ended up improving. So his GFR went to 30, so he started at a reduced dose of lenalidomide based on that GFR, but it improved, and bortezomib sub-Q and dexamethasone. After 4 monthly cycles, he tolerated the regimen quite well, and he had a VGPR, 90% reduction in his serum M-protein. So his SPEP, remember he was 4 grams per deciliter at diagnosis, went to 0.3 grams. He had a little bit of a scapular itchy rash in both arms, but he worked with the nurse practitioner to get that target len dose down. He had steroid-induced hyperglycemia again, using the multidisciplinary team members. The nurse practitioner worked with the PCP and the patient to control the blood sugars. As I mentioned, the creatinine improved. He still had a reduced GFR, but his creatinine went to 1.9, beta 2 microglobulin came down, and his monoclonal spike was gone.
And I think it's important that particularly when he starts treatment initially, he should be monitored carefully to make sure that he doesn't have severe cytopenias, and as you mentioned, hyperglycemia from the steroids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was started on acyclovir to minimize the risk of shingles. I'm aware that there's a Shingrix vaccine that's currently available. And in that study of that live inactivated vaccine, it did include hematologic cancer patients as well. The vaccine at this time that we're having this discussion is not readily available, but that might be something for to consider. But Dr. Giralt, what are your thoughts regarding transplant for this patient? He's doing quite well. He had an excellent response. What would his goals be?
So this is a very interesting question. And again, as we look and even in younger populations, our goal is to achieve a complete remission and preferably a stringent complete remission and an MRD negative complete remission. Because we know that the patients who get to this goal are the ones that do the best. Actually, the Spanish have retrospective data suggesting that only patients who get an MRD negative CR are the ones who are actually doing best. Our data actually suggests that depth of response is important and that CRs do better than PRs, that, you know, and that obviously PRs do better than people who don't respond. So I think it's important to have a frank conversation with this patient at this time, advise him that he's not in a complete remission, advise him that he is eligible for transplant. What are the absolute contraindications? If he was frail and poor performance status, we wouldn't consider this. If he had poor caregiver support, we would not consider this. If he had very low-risk disease, like an ISS stage 1 with a complete remission to induction therapy, we would not consider this. Or if he was over the age of 85 where his life expectancy was not going to be 10 years, we would actually say, you know, you're probably better off keeping going on some form of continued therapy and enjoying your life. And obviously, if a patient doesn't want to do it, we should not do it. So he has no absolute or relative contraindications. He has failed to achieve a complete response to the best available treatment. I think he would benefit from high-dose melphalan. And, you know, the data for patients over the age of 60 who get high-dose melphalan is the same as patients who are less than age of 60. So the benefit is the same in regards to progression-free survival and potentially overall survival benefit. But I think the most important thing is high-dose melphalan is the most active drug in multiple myeloma. Now, to be able to deliver high-dose melphalan safely, we need to be able to support the patient with stem cells. And actually with this, many times we can do this as an outpatient. The transplant journey is divided in 5 phases. The chemotherapy phase, which is very well tolerated, minimal nausea and vomiting. The cytopenic phase, in which patients' white count goes down to 0. They may require transfusions, they may require infections, but counts recover within 10 days. The early recovery phase is a transition phase. Many of us actually transplant patients like him. If he had good caregiver support, we would do it as an outpatient, with half of the patients never having to spend a day in the hospital. The early convalescent phase is a time of immune recovery, where patients should avoid crowds and people who are sick because their immune system is still recovering and they're more predisposed to infection. After 1 year, patients' immune system has recovered to the point that they should get revaccinated. Now, despite the fact that we know that high-dose melphalan is a very effective treatment, in older patients, it is severely underutilized. Less than 20% of patients over the age of 65 are actually getting high-dose melphalan. Many of them are not even being referred to transplant. And if you're African-American, your chances of getting transplanted if you're over 65 is almost in single digits. So we really need to do a better job of educating our community physicians as well as our patients that high-dose melphalan and autologous transplant is a valid approach for patients up to the age of 80. So what are the benefits of early transplants? Patients are as young as they're going to be. This is the healthiest they're going to be. Their myeloma is going to be the least resistance, and I think it's actually the quickest return to a new normal. It is true that a quarter of patients may spend 5 years without having relapsed, without having received upfront transplant. The risk of complications are very low, but they're not zero. And it can take 3 months to get back to the point where you started. Patients who opt for delayed transplant, you know, conserve their quality of life in the early part of the disease journey. A quarter of them may actually never, you know, have their disease relapse, so they're hedging their bets. And it has minimal disruption to their lifestyle. The main disadvantage of trying to opt of delayed transplant is 2/3 of these patients will be undergoing transplant within 2 years of their diagnosis, and the transplant will be as easy or as hard at that time as it was going to be early. I do think this is a personal choice. It's a choice that patients make based on the recommendations of their physicians and based on their priorities. So transplant's a choice, it's not a necessity. I happen to think that it's probably the best choice for most patients, particularly for somebody like this patient who failed to achieve a complete response to an optimal induction treatment. Beth, let's review the treatment options for non-transplant eligible patients.
Absolutely. We had a nice slide early on that discussed the first trial, which was continuous lenalidomide dexamethasone, that's reasonable. And an RVD light is reasonable, as well as the Dara bortezomib, melphalan, and dexamethasone. So those are the clinical trials that inform our recommendation. But I like to think of it as in classes of drugs. And this is particularly exciting because when I started taking care of myeloma patients in the 1990s, like Dr. Giralt, we had no idea that there would be classes of drugs in the future. So the proteasome inhibitors, alkylating agents, immunomodulatory agents, and monoclonal antibodies all can be mixed and matched with corticosteroids that will provide a best optimal induction. I think what our gentleman had gotten, the RVD, he could have just continued that for 8 cycles, similar to the SWOG 777 study, which was published and showed that after 8 cycles of the RVD induction, patients that were not upfront transplanted still had excellent outcomes. After that, they go on to len maintenance, and so that would be something to consider. We already discussed the supportive care possibility with the shingles and the shingrits. And I also briefly mentioned the bone modifying agents. We used to just call them bisphosphonates, but now denosumab is a sub-Q injection that's FDA approved for patients with bone disease and myeloma. And what's nice is that there's no dose reduction needed. It's actually contraindicated to give bisphosphonates such as pimidronate and zoledronic acid to individuals with a GFR of less than 30, but denosumab, you don't have to worry about that. Of course, we need a baseline dental exam, if possible, and regular dental monitoring to reduce the risk of osteonecrosis. And then finally, the disease and organ monitoring is also important. So when we talk about the dose modifications, I think if you set yourself up for success by determining the correct dose of the drug, then you're going to be then you're going to be okay. So the IMiDs don't require dose reduction necessarily. Bortezomib and carfilzomib are safe. Exasimib requires a dose reduction in relapse disease is when we primarily use that drug, 3 milligrams starting dose, as well as others. And I would refer you to the package inserts and the prescribing information primarily for those. So he received MEL-200. It was compelling to him. He wanted to have a better, hopefully, remission status. That first remission is likely your best remission, and the deepest remission up front will hopefully carry you. I think Dr. Giralt will present some data on MRD status in myeloma in just a few moments, but he had MEL-200. He was MRD negative, so there was very little disease found in his bone marrow at that time. There's a big question in this gentleman, maintenance for no maintenance. And there was a big meta-analysis that showed the benefit in progression-free survival in patients who had lenalidomide maintenance after autologous stem cell transplant. And he said, okay, I did fine on the 15 milligrams of the lenalidomide. So he stayed on that for maintenance, continued the supportive care with the bone modifying agents as well. Any other thoughts with this case study, Dr. Giralt?
Actually, I mean, I'm glad that he opted for maintenance. I think, again, the data for maintenance is actually very compelling. I actually start maintenance at the lower dose of 5 milligrams every other day, partly because his creatinine was still a little bit on the high side, and then I escalate it. I do syncopated maintenance, which is 21 days out of 28. In spite of having an MRD negative CR, almost 4 years later, he has reoccurrence in his M spike and now progressed with lytic lesions. So I actually have said that this is the type of case that, you know, we're kind of disappointed because we would have expected that with an MRD negative CR, he would have had almost a 7 year time of progression free. But he probably had, and as we would learn when we do his bone marrow, he probably has high-risk cytogenetic clones that are the ones that emerge. It also underscores the fact that these patients need to be monitored carefully because the myeloma can come back at any time, even though the majority of patients on lenalidomide maintenance actually do very well. So what is the data for MRD? MRD is now, we call it measurable residual disease, more than minimal residual disease. There's two assays that we can do, flow cytometry and next generation sequencing. We know based on the French study that in an assay in which you can detect 1 in 1 million myeloma cells, that patients who have measurable residual disease negativity, which means less than 1 in 1 million myeloma cells, actually do very well. You can stop lenalidomide therapy and 20% of them will relapse within 2 years, but that means that 80% of them will stay in remission. However, if you're MRD positive and you stop lenalidomide therapy based on the IFM DFCI 2009 trial, 80% of these patients will go on to relapse within 2 years. Now, the practice in the United States is lenalidomide until progression. Why? We don't have a real indication for minimal residual disease assessment at this time, but I think this is the one place where I use MRD to dictate treatment. Because I convince patients or I encourage patients to stay on maintenance therapy as long as they're MRD positive. In patients who have low risk disease, who have been MRD negative for many years, I actually do have the conversation of stopping treatment or stopping maintenance. Although the meta-analysis, as you suggested, suggests a significant survival benefit, it's important to recognize that second primary malignancies occur at a higher rate in patients on lenalidomide maintenance, 6% versus 2%, that the increased risk of solid tumors seems to be less. But these patients need to be monitored carefully, and patients who have unexplained cytopenia should have a bone marrow to rule out the emergence of either myelodysplastic syndrome or an acute leukemia. Once again, very rare, and the benefits of lenalidomide maintenance outweigh the risks, but we need to be monitoring and following these patients very carefully. And particularly, as I said, in patients with very low risk disease, the risk of second primary malignancies has to be weighed against the benefits of lenalidomide maintenance. Okay, Beth, let's wrap up this case and summarize. So I think what we've been discussing today is that patients with comorbidities can safely receive therapy to control myeloma, that aggressive treatment should not be held on the basis of age, that comprehensive geriatric assessment can help in the decision of go or no go in an older patient with myeloma and should be routine. That a team approach is needed to manage issues surrounding treatment with comorbid illness, and that all patients should be encouraged to participate in clinical trials. Beth, thank you for joining me, and let's thank the audience for joining us for this presentation. We hope this information will be useful to you in the care of your patients.